Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Are you interested in a social lubricant? Perhaps social glue? Or even an antidote to depression? Well, stay tuned. You're in the right place here at Radio Curious. In this edition, we visit with Stephen Sultanoff, who portrays himself as a mirthologist and humorologist with a PhD in psychology. Dr. Sultanoff uses humor in his work and regularly in his daily life. He and I met when Radio Curious attended the 11th Milton Erickson Psychotherapy Congress in Phoenix, Arizona in early December of 2011, where Stephen Sultanoff presented a workshop about the importance of humor in psychotherapy and daily life. I laughed at some of what he said and asked him if we could visit in front of the Radio Curious microphones. He agreed. We began as he described the role of humor in society and in his professional practice.
Probably one of the best ways to look at it is that humor is a social lubricant. That is to say, when we experience positive humor, warm, empathic, caring humor, it tends to build our relationships, it bonds us together, it makes people happier to be around each other. So at a societal level, the use of humor can be really seen as a social glue, something that puts us together, brings us pleasure, builds relationships.
But in a cross-cultural situation, there may be abstractions or something that's funny in one culture that's not funny in another culture.
Well, you're absolutely correct that there may be some cross-cultural differences in terms of what's perceived as funny. But the experience of humor is universal. Every culture has humor within it and uses humor. The difference would be how within that particular culture a situation is perceived as funny or not funny. So it's a good point that you make. If people are from different cultures and trying to share humor with each other, it may be that there may be a mismatch. They may not understand the humor. But certainly within a culture, it does serve as that bonding and social glue.
So staying within any given culture, we understand that children laugh hundreds of times a day. Adults laugh less than 20 times a day. What happens that limits the mirth, the humor, as we grow up? It's not so funny anymore?
Well, I don't know that it's not so funny anymore, but it's really a great question. What does happen? And a number of things happen. One is that children are accepted as laughers and being silly, but when you begin to, quote, mature, there are all sorts of cultural messages about laughing being less than. In other words, if you're laughing, you're not supposed to be, that people who are silly or funny are sometimes even viewed as less smart. So there are all sorts of messages that children later on as they grow older are given not to laugh.
Those messages in different cultures might be different.
Yes, absolutely. Although most cultures, as someone, in quote, matures, the act of laughing or being silly, certainly, I think, is seen as negative trait as one matures. It's almost as though maturity or getting older is the opposite of being silly or playful and carefree.
Comparing the cultural differences, where you describe people in many societies expected to be serious as we grow up, giving up the frivolity of childhood. In Bhutan, a small country located in the Himalayas, the measure of success in their society is gross national happiness compared to, in the United States, gross national product. Do you have any thoughts on that cultural direction?
Wow. The first thing is that I'm just amazed. I find it really remarkable. And certainly, in my eyes, as a therapeutic humorist, a positive view, my wondering, I mean, here's an exception to what would be the norm. And so my thinking on that is, how does that happen? How does a culture become more focused on what I would consider the human being of life, because happiness to me is about being, as opposed to most, certainly Western cultures, that it's viewed, we're viewed as human doings, and that happiness is about doing. So I find it remarkable. I find it encouraging, and I would also be curious to find out how that all plays out in both their happiness and the other side would being, and their productivity.
Your experiences in using humor in therapy, can you talk about the specific physiological changes that occur among your clients?
Sure. First, I wouldn't want to give you the impression that I'm anti-medication, because I certainly have clients that use medication. But you're correct, my work is much more psychological, emotional, behavioral. But in terms of the physiological benefits of humor or laughter, there are a number of benefits. The studies have shown that when people have deep, heartfelt laughter, that their antibodies go up. So antibodies that fight infection, that fight upper respiratory disease, tend to be increased with deep, heartfelt laughter. In addition, we often hear that laughter is an antidote to stress. And experientially, we know that's true. When people laugh, they feel less distressed. But biochemically, we also know that when people laugh, there are a number of studies that show that serum cortisol, which is the hormone secreted when we're under stress, is decreased with that deep kind of heartfelt laughter. But some of the best research in laughter looks at pain tolerance. And what we find is that when people have deep heartfelt laughter, they have an increased tolerance to pain. So for example, when I'm on my way to the dentist and I know I'm going to get some dental work done, a filling or a root canal or whatever, I pop Robin Williams into my CD player in my car and I listen to Robin Williams on the way to the dentist. I laugh as hard as I can, hoping that the research will be effective for me. That is, that by laughing, my tolerance to pain will be of greater tolerance to pain, so I'll be less sensitive to the pain. And there are a number of studies that show that.
Does it work for you?
You know, I don't know. You know, it's hard to tell, does it work, does it not work? I can tell you that when I go into the dentist, I do not feel much pain. So I can tell you that that's true, although in
general... That's true with me, unless I have a toothache. Well, if I don't have a toothache, it doesn't hurt.
It doesn't hurt. But while I'm talking about, I may not have a toothache, but she starts drilling, and I can feel some pain, or even the pain of the Novocaine, of getting the needle. So it's hard to tell, does it really work? But in terms of the research, there are enough studies now that show that with deep heartfelt laughter, there is an increased tolerance to pain.
How about other areas within the psyche or within the physiology of the human?
I mean, in terms of humor?
Yes.
In my work, perhaps the most important impact of humor is not that humor activates laughter, which I see as a physical experience, and again, the research really connects laughter to physiological benefits, but I see humor as activating what I call mirth. And for me, mirth is an emotional experience. And as a psychologist, what I'm trying to do is help clients to feel better, to experience emotions differently, to be able to manage their emotions more effectively, to learn that they can manage emotions. And so humor, if I use humor with a client, and that client feels differently, they feel the joy, the pleasure, the uplift of humor, I'm teaching them how they can also manage their emotional distress with humor. So that's the second really important element to me of using humor with clients. The third is that humor can change the way we view the world. It adds perspective. Classic examples of this would be Larson cartoons or Ziggy cartoons, Peanuts cartoons. We'll look at those cartoons and we might not guffaw, but we get the cartoon. It puts the world in perspective. And in the realm of psychotherapy, one of the major treatments in psychotherapy is to help clients gain perspective. So humor helps gain perspective through what I call wit, and it helps gain emotional management through what I call mirth. And then there's the physiological benefit, which we know from the research from the experience of laughter.
Within cognitive therapy, for instance, a person who is reluctant to find a therapist to deal with problems, but realizes that those problems are continuing, either personally or in a relationship situation?
Well, if somebody's reluctant to find a therapist, that is kind of a step before, to me, even beginning to use humor. That in order to be able to proceed in psychotherapy, the person has to be motivated enough to want to make changes. But when someone comes to me and say they're reluctant to be in therapy, the very first thing that's critical for all psychotherapy is to build a relationship. Now, sometimes that relationship can be built by the use of humor. And let me give you an example of an actual client situation. A number of years ago, I had a client that came to me, and when a client sees me, they fill out paperwork in the beginning, biographical information, and etc. So I looked at her intake form, and on it, during the past 6 months, she had seen 3 therapists for 2 visits each. So that told me, as your question, that she may have been reluctant to proceed in therapy. So during the first session, I asked her about that. I said, it's interesting to me that during the past 6 months, you've seen 3 different therapists, each for 2 visits. Can you tell me a little more about that? And she said, well, each therapist was okay, and she liked each one. But at the second visit, they began to want her to explore the depth of her feelings and to talk about what was going on with her, and they seemed to want to connect. And so I looked at her and I said, well, let me get this straight. Then you're looking for a therapist who will be somewhat distant, who won't help you to get into your emotions, and basically stay semi-aloof in the therapy. And she looked at me and she started laughing, because she understood that that was ridiculous, that if you go to therapy, the goal of therapy is to become engaged and explore. And that's an example of experiencing the absurdity, ludicrousness, which is one of the main activators of a sense of humor. So that happened in the first visit. She comes in for the second visit. At the beginning of the second visit, we sit down, and I say to her, since this will be our final session, what would you like to focus on? And she burst out laughing. What I had done by those 2 little humor interventions is I had bonded with her in a way that the other therapist hadn't. Now, it could be that she was ready to continue in therapy at that point anyway, but I think that that bonding, that my way of communicating to her that I really understand what you're going through, that I get it, that you're afraid and that you're hesitant, allowed her to be present. And she actually then continued in therapy for about 1.5 years, and she only terminated therapy because she moved out of the area.
In this edition of Radio Curious, we're visiting with Steve Sultanoff, a PhD in psychology, at the 11th International Congress on Ericksonian Approaches to Psychotherapy. And this interview was recorded on December 9th, 2011, in Phoenix, Arizona. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Let's talk about Aikido and how it affects humor.
Humor Aikido is basically the action of what many people have heard of, which is when the world gives you lemons, make lemonade. It's an illustration of bringing some negative force that's coming toward you and turning it to the side. So as one example, many years ago, Eve Arden, the actress Eve Arden, was on stage doing a play, and she was walking across the stage toward a table that had a prop telephone on it. The telephone wasn't supposed to ring, but suddenly the phone rang. And it rang again. And she looked across the stage at her leading man, and she could see the twinkle in his eye that he had gotten her. She walked over to the phone at the third ring, and she picked it up, and she answered the phone, and she said, "Hello." Turning to her leading man, she said, "It's for you." That's humor Aikido. That's taking the lemons of the world and moving them to the side. A clinical example of that, I had a client a number of years ago who had social phobia, very concerned about what people thought of him, and he went into a hair salon to get his hair cut, and he took his newborn baby with him. So he gets his hair cut, he's all done and about to leave, and it had started to rain outside. And the hairstylist called to him and said, "Oh, be sure to cover the baby." At that moment, he felt attacked. He felt as though she were saying, "You don't know how to be a good father. You don't know how to take care of your child." And he didn't say anything, and he left, but he was very upset and distressed. So he comes into therapy and he's telling me about this situation. And as he's reliving it, he's becoming more distressed. One of the things that I did with him is I said, let's look at all the different ways that you might have responded, from saying nothing to getting very angry and aggressive and saying nasty things to her. And I said to him, not that you would say any of this, but let's just come up with some things. So we started coming up with things, and he said things like, I could have told her, it's none of your business, I know what I'm doing. And so as he said those, I'd ask him, and how would you feel having done that? And he said, well, no, I feel like I want something else, I didn't want to be aggressive. So we kept going, and he at one point came up with what I consider to be a couple of humor Aikido items. One of them was, he said, well, I could have said to her, don't worry about the baby, he hasn't had a shower yet today. And I asked him, if you had said that to her, how would you have felt? And he said, well, I would have felt really good that I had responded to her and been playful. And then he said, and I have another idea. I could have said to her, oh, don't worry about the baby, we had him scotch guarded at the hospital. Now what that did, which is it didn't change the incident, but it's making lemonade out of lemons. Now he could visualize himself in that situation saying that to the hairstylist and feel much better. In that way, it retroactively corrected the memory, didn't change what actually happened, but made him feel better about what did happen, and it prepared him for the next time. So the next time, maybe he would be able to better deal with such a situation, or maybe not. And if he couldn't deal with it well the next time, he would have the process that I took him through of looking for the Aikido that he might go through on his own to learn to be able to do that more and more on his own.
I think you call that process planned spontaneity. Remembering a phrase, gosh, I missed it at that point and I could have or should have said, and next time that circumstance comes up, you're ready.
Yes, planned spontaneity is actually a characteristic that most comedians use. If you watch things like Jay Leno and David Letterman, they get up and they do their monologues and it appears that they're spontaneous, but even when their jokes go flat, they have planning to respond to it. So planned spontaneity is planning but using it spontaneously. So for example, in my office I keep a collection of hard copy cartoons. I have a collection of jokes in my head, and I don't sit down with a client and say, oh, look at these cartoons or hear this joke. But if I'm talking to the client about a specific situation, then I might either show them the cartoon, describe the cartoon, or tell them the joke. So for example, I was talking with a mother of a teenager, and she was saying how her teenager was so difficult and how alien he was, and as teenagers become, very hard to deal with. And I said, you know, it reminds me of the cartoon, and I described this cartoon that I have. It reminds me of the cartoon of two mothers sitting in the living room of the house chatting, and off to the side, walking up the steps, is a teenage boy with piercings and ragged clothing and wild hair. And one mother, the mother of the boy, says to the other, I wonder if it's too late to sue my obstetrician. And so that's an example of planned spontaneity. I had the cartoon in my head, but I might use it once a year or once every 5 years, but it's there to be there and planned to be used spontaneously when the situation is right for it.
I remember you telling a story about a client of yours who didn't like your jokes.
Yes, this was a situation where I have had a client for a number of years, and I always introduce her as being my client who's absolutely dedicated to her depression. There's sometimes people who want to hold on to their emotional distress. In her case, it was depression. And one of the reasons she wanted to hold on to her depression is because of what we call in psychological terms secondary gains. Basically, they're the benefits of being depressed. By being depressed, she got people to come and take care of her. By being depressed, she had excuses not to work or an excuse not to be with family, not to go and do things. So she was really motivated not to be, to stay depressed, not to get better. And yet, she was insistent that she wanted to get better. Well, over the years of therapy that I worked with her, I used many different modalities, including a psychodynamic modality, which basically means I did a lot of interpreting of these gains and pretty much presenting to her why she wanted to be depressed. And she denied it and denied it and denied it. So at one point, I decided it was probably time to end treatment because I wasn't helping her in the way I had hoped. And I thought, well, before I end treatment, let me try some humor. This was at the beginning of my humor career. I said, let me try it. Nothing else has worked. So she came in for a session, sat down, we did the session. I did something funny. And she said, I don't like when you do that. And I said to her, I know, and I let it go. The next week she came in, I did something funny. She became a little more adamant. She said, I don't like when you do that. And I said, I know. Third week she came in, I did something funny again, a little bit more adamant, and she said, I really don't like when you use humor with me. And I said to her, what is it about my using humor that upsets you? And she looked me in the eye and she said, when you make me laugh, I don't feel depressed. And in that moment, the insight that she gained about her own being dedicated to staying depressed hit. And she looked at me somewhat shocked and horrified. And that was basically the end of the session. 2 weeks later, she comes back in to see me, and she said, you know, this humor stuff really works. And I was shocked. I couldn't imagine what is it that could possibly have been so good. And especially given I had just done such a minor humor intervention. And she said to me, last weekend, I was really depressed. I went to Blockbuster, I rented a Woody Allen movie, I watched the movie, and after watching the movie and laughing for an hour and a half, I felt really much better. That was the beginning of her for a complete turnaround, where she now uses humor to feel less depressed. She uses humor with other people. She's very playful and teasing with me, and her whole lifestyle has shifted. In fact, one day she told me that in terms of the things she values in life, her religion is her number one value in life, and her sense of humor and her use of humor is her number two, which I thought was really quite remarkable.
What motivated you to become a psychotherapist?
Wow, what motivated me to become a psychotherapist? And I assume you're meaning a psychotherapist as opposed to a psychotherapist.
Right, in your professional genre.
Yeah, yeah. It was really one of those things that just sort of happened to me. When I was a teenager, I was involved in some leadership training, and the leadership training was very humanistically oriented, and I became interested in human interactions. And I went to college and was going to major in journalism, and in my first journalism class, the instructor said, if you can't type 60 words a minute, get out. And I got out. That was the end of my journalism career because I was very naive. I fell into taking psychology classes by accident. And when I was looking at graduating college, I looked at what can I graduate in? What do I have the most units? It was psychology. So it was really kind of that. And it even goes on from there. As I was graduating college, I was told, well, you have to go on to graduate school because you can't do anything with a degree in psychology. I didn't know what I was going to do. And I met a man on the beach in Miami, and he and I started talking. And he said, it sounds like you're interested in clinical psychology. And I said to him, what's that? I didn't even know. I was a psychology major. He turned out to be a chairman of a psychology department at a small college. He and I got to know each other. He wrote me letters of reference, and that's the direction. And it really was quite that. Even though it fits for my personality, that's how I fell into it. And yet, in high school and even in college, I was really a scientist. My strong skills are in math and science. So it was kind of a twist to be in psychology.
Was the humor aspect something you were born with, or did it just kind of evolve and nurture, self-nurture?
Yeah, the humor part. I can tell you that not one of my friends wrote in my high school yearbook, GC, Steve, you're a funny guy. And I can tell you not one of my friends from that era and time can believe that I'm in the humor business. I was always a very playful child, and maybe playful, creative, but not humorous. I was not the class clown. I was not the person telling jokes, not particularly funny. And that maintained itself through college and even through graduate school. I went to UC Berkeley, which is a very serious research institution. In my 7 years there, I don't think the word humor was mentioned once. And basically, what happened was the coming together of a number of things. The first was, in 1985, I went to the Ericksonian Evolution of Psychotherapy Conference, and they had a session on using humor in psychotherapy. They had over 500 people in that room with four panelists talking about using humor. I was really interested, and yet the panelists, I thought, were very superficial and knew very little about humor. 6 months later, I went to a humor conference, and there was a discussion on using humor in psychotherapy. And the person presenting there knew humor, but knew nothing about psychotherapy. So my thinking was, the therapists don't know humor, and the humor people don't know therapy. There's got to be something here. The third thing that happened is I was in training, and I was learning a model of psychotherapy that looked at the interaction of how we feel, how we think, how we behave, and our physiology, and how that's all influenced by the environment. And as I'm learning that model of psychotherapy, I had an aha moment. And the aha moment was, humor intervenes in those same four areas. It changes how we think, how we feel, how we act, and our physiology. And I got really excited that here was a niche, and here was something that nobody was talking about. So that's how I fell into it. The next thing was trying to find anybody that knew anything about humor. So one thing that I used to do is I would peruse the hallways of the universities where I was teaching or nearby universities. And one day I saw a flyer, and it was for the first annual or second annual conference of the American Association for Therapeutic Humor in Chicago in November. And here I live in Southern California. And I thought, I'll bet my people are there. Sure enough, I found a group of people who really knew therapeutic humor. And I've become very involved in that organization ever since. So that's how I fell into humor.
Well, Steve Sultanoff, I want to thank you for being with us on Radio Curious. And I think you just answered one of the questions I always like to ask my guests, and that is about an aha or eureka moment.
Oh, yes, definitely. That was a eureka moment.
So tell us what you would like to do with the rest of your one precious life.
Wow. What I would like to do with the rest of my one precious life, from a fun level, play more softball. I'm an avid softball player. I currently play on two teams. Get back to playing the guitar. I haven't been playing much. I'm writing a book currently. I'd like to get that book written. It's on the cognitive therapy of anxiety, and I have material in there that's cutting edge, new, that I haven't seen anybody else talking about.
Is there a book that you've read that you could recommend to our listeners?
There sure is. And in fact, it's one author, three or four books, depending on how you look at it. The one book, if it was only one, would be Blink by Malcolm Gladwell. And Blink is about how we all perceive the world in the blink of an eye. It's about how we've been trained to see the world. So for example, if I told you, and I mentioned earlier my dentist, if I told you about my dentist, you would probably have an image of a dentist, but it probably would be of a male, that you would blink male because your experience is male. My dentist happens to be female. So that's what Blink is about. He's also written other books. One's called Outliers. His other book, his first book, is The Tipping Point.
Well, Steve Sultanoff, thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Steven Sultanoff, PhD, is a specialist in the use of humor in psychotherapy. He calls himself a mirthologist, and you may learn more about him at his website, mirthmatters.com. That's MIRTHMATTERS. The books that Steven Sultanoff recommends are all by Malcolm Gladwell, Blink, Outliers, and The Tipping Point. All Radio Curious programs are free at our website, radiocurious.org. Our phone is 707-462-6541. Email is curious@radiocurious.org. Christina Onestad is our associate producer. I'm host and producer, Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.